Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, what animals reveal about our senses, with Jackie Higgins and her new book, Sentient.
Jackie Higgins is a television documentary director and writer who read zoology at Oxford University as a student of Richard Dawkins. She made wildlife films for a decade for the BBC, as well as Channel 4, National Geographic and the Discovery Channel. And then she joined the BBC's science department, researching and writing, directing and producing programmes such as Tomorrow's World and Horizon. And Jackie is the author of Sentient, What Animals Reveal About Our Senses, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Jackie, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much for having me, Neil.
Tell us, first of all, then, what the idea is behind the book.
So I've always been fascinated by how animals, other animals, non-human animals, sense the world. But my interest in zoology mainly has been to better understand myself. So the book is about considering other creatures in the animal kingdom and how they sense the world, but them throwing light on how we sense the world, how we see the world, how we smell it, how we taste it, hear it. And so each chapter takes a different creature. And the thing with perception is that it's so much part of our everyday, our every waking moment, that we take a lot for granted. So using these animals, it enabled me a little bit of distance on ourselves, myself, so that I could better understand ourselves, myself, I suppose.
And let's spend some time talking about what we mean by sentience then.
Yes, well, that's the million-dollar question. It's a sentient is a mercurial word. It comes from the Latin sentire, to feel. And some people use it interchangeably with the word consciousness. Other people think of it as the lowest grade of consciousness. So the experience of seeing or the experience of hearing. But in this book, I do something simpler. So I basically took a leaf out of Daniel Dennett's book, who was talking about the difficulties with defining sentience, this idea that there's a special ingredient, a magic ingredient X, that distinguishes either of those forms of sentience from mere sensitivity. And because we can't pinpoint that magic ingredient, he proposes a conservative hypothesis that there is no such extra phenomenon, that sentience comes in every imaginable grade or intensity. Those were his words. So that's the approach I use. I use sentience in this very broad sense in terms of sensing the world. So that could be the most kind of robotic sensitivity, or it could be, you know, a much more exquisitely sensitive, hyperreactive human. But taking that broader definition of sentience, it enabled me to look at the whole animal kingdom, essentially. I mean, in the book, I'm comparing us with invertebrates, with moths, with peacock mantis shrimps, as well as mammals like vampire bats and all sorts of creatures. So that's the definition I chose.
The idea of our senses, so, you know, historically, classically, we think of around 5 senses, which, you know, you could ask anyone, any man in the street, and they would be able to come up with what we think of are the 5 main senses. But actually, of course, there are many more than that.
Many more. And yes, we're all taught this at nursery. I watch my kids come back from nursery and, you know, talk about the 5 senses. But it's not just kind of everyday lay context. It's also in scientific contexts. that these five senses are kind of the predominant myth, essentially. And as I was researching our senses, you know, the common view within neuroscience is that there are many more than five. So not only do the five we know splinter and fracture, so touches many different senses. I mean, part of the question is a philosophical question, which is, how does one define a sense? So if you're defining a sense according to the sensor within our body, an animal's body that receives the information, if you take the eye, for example, you have rods, which are the sensor for light that enable us to see in the dark. But you also have in the human retina, typically, although as you'll learn from my book, not always, you have three colour photoreceptors. So you could say that we've got four senses of colour, or you could perhaps, if you're talking about the experience, you could talk about having two senses of colour, the ability to see in the dark and the ability to see colour. Taste also, if you talk about the taste receptors on our tongue, you've got the sweet receptors, the salty receptors, the bitter and the sour receptors, and maybe also the umami receptors. So that's four or five maybe senses of taste if you're talking about categorizing a sense according to a sensor. In the book, again, I take the experiential. I use taste as one sense. Touch is a really interesting sense. I mean, when I first started the research, I thought this might be the most pedestrian of the senses. But as one of my neuroscientists, Francis McGlone, describes, he calls touch the last sensory frontier. And our skin is full of so many different types of sensors. We have mechanoreceptors, Meissner cells, Pacinian, Ruffini, Merkel cells, which enable us to, with our fingertips, feel the topography of a surface, its roughness or smoothness, its shape, contours, its size. But we also, within our skin, have sensors that detect temperature, temperatures that are too cold and too hot that, you know, are painful. So we also have pain. We have pleasure sensors. We have itch sensors. So in the book, I decided to categorize touch as two senses. So one, which scientists refer to as discriminative touch, which enables us to feel the lay of the land, and another, which scientists call affective touch, which is the more emotional side of touching, if you will, the being touched and the emotions that it generates. And I haven't even talked about the senses that Aristotle didn't know he had, the ones that work beneath his, you know, would have worked beneath his consciousness, and the ones that work beneath our consciousness. So that's the second part of the book, with some really interesting senses that people might not necessarily have noted.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at some examples, talk about some of the animals and some of the senses. And what I'd like to do is talk about a couple of the more obvious classic senses, those being sight and smell.
Yeah.
And then we'll look at a couple of the weirder ones that we don't necessarily know we have and we can't feel. And so, yeah, obviously, the obvious place to start is the peacock mantis shrimp, which has, well, you can tell us about its incredible, well, or at least what we thought, because
yes,
might not be as incredible as we thought. But what we, on first glance, pun intended, looks to be the most incredible eyes in the natural world.
Absolutely. I mean, these eyes, so this little shrimp, you know, you'll find it on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, for example. It's beautifully coloured, and it's got these protuberant kind of orbs that swivel, which are its eyes, which swivel in different directions independently of one another. I mean, its eyes are a completely bizarre. It looks alien. And there's a wonderful story. And as a, what I do throughout the book is I allow the scientists to tell their story of how they discovered things about these creatures. So Justin Marshall tells the story of how he realized that the shrimp eye was spectacular. I mentioned earlier that we have three cone cells in our retina that enables us to see the rainbows that we see. It enables us to see all color. But Marshall quickly discovered that the shrimp has very many more than three. And it basically, when he realized that the shrimp had, you know, 12 color photoreceptors, and it has other photoreceptors as well beyond color, it can see polarized light, and it can see different types of polarized light, like circularly polarized light. It can see UV. I mean, it's quite staggering. But with its 12 color photoreceptors, when people learnt this, they thought that I mean, they couldn't even begin to imagine what the world of a shrimp appeared to a shrimp. Language like thermonuclear bombs of colour were used. And I mean, it's impossible to imagine. I mean, we're so fixed with our current view on the world, it's impossible to imagine what it would have seen. So through this shrimp, we learn how our colour photoreceptors work. And in the chapter, we meet a lady called Gabrielle Jordan, who looked at the human eye and discovered that there are some women who have 4 colour photoreceptors who will see millions of colours more than most of us. That's the story of the shrimp and colour sight.
And you look also at, you know, how we can study our sight through, and this is something that, you know, crops up a lot through the book. Studying our understanding of our senses is developed by studying people whose, you know, senses are not working properly or are like affected in a certain way. And you talk in this book about a particular island in the South Pacific where colour blindness is endemic.
Yes. Complete colour blindness. So achromatopsia. So no cones are working. So they see a large proportion of the population of Pingalap, this island, see the world in black and white. And this is a theme. I talk about people either with an excess, like the people who Gabrielle Jordan was studying, or missing something. So the achromatopes who have never seen colour. I think the interesting, so Oliver Sacks went off to Pingalap. He was fascinated by this, I think, because he'd had migraines as a child. And at certain points, his migraine had drained his world of colour. So he'd lost colour sight through these migraines. And he was really fascinated by this condition. And he had also met a painter called Jonathan Eye, who had had a car accident and had lost his sense of colour. Jonathan Eye described to Sacks that his world was dirty and impure. He talked about people's flesh now looking rat-coloured, or the world being moulded in lead. I mean, he had lost something. But what was interesting is that Sacks travelled to Pingalap with a scientist called Knut Norby, who was born an achromatope, who was born without the ability to see colour. And when asked about what it meant for him, he very clearly said that my world is, I don't view it as dirty or not pure. I don't view it as, I don't think I'm missing anything. And Sacks talks about Nordby's black and white photography. And he asks the question, which I thought was fascinating, which is maybe colour blinds us to much of what the world offers. So I do use this idea of, I talk about this idea of excess and senses or lacking senses. And we make assumptions quite often when someone senses the world in the way that we don't, that somehow they're missing out on something, which sometimes they are. But I suppose I'm trying to suggest we don't make assumptions.
Well, one of the assumptions we obviously made in this chapter is this idea that, you know, we looked at the peacock mantis shrimp, saw that it had 12 colour receptors rather than 3, and obviously thought that would make its eyesight insanely good, as you said, a thermonuclear explosion of colour. And of course, you know, that's almost like this sort of fallacy that evolution is working towards some sort of like ultimate end, when actually it may well be the case that it's like massively over-engineered something that works, you know, not necessarily that dissimilar to our own eyesight.
Yes, but dissimilar in that these 12 photos. So when Justin Marshall decided to figure out, he'd been looking at the sensors and making an assumption about what the sight might be from how many sensors it had. But when the scientists started to test what the shrimp could actually see, they realized that their color vision was much worse than ours. And so it's using these 12 photoreceptors in a very different way. I mean, the way that we use our 3 colour photoreceptors, we compare the input of these colour, of, you know, these 3 inputs coming in. And that enables us to calculate this extraordinary rainbow. And so the shrimp's not doing that. It's seeing the world in a very different way, with more kit, but less results.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Jackie Higgins, and we're talking about her new book, Sentient, What Animals Reveal About Our Senses. And Jackie, let's move on to smell, the sense of smell. And in the book, you look at the bloodhound particularly, but, you know, dogs. And this idea that we've had for a while that, you know, dogs have, again, a sense of smell that's exponentially better than our own. It's often occurred to me that to have much better smell in that sort of way would be a bad thing, because the things that smelt bad would smell like exponentially worse as well. But
yes,
the whole world would just stink terribly of things. But I guess that's not actually how it works.
That's how it works with taste, by the way. I think people who are super tasters actually have problems eating their food. But no, so smell, yes, we've hailed the doggy nose as the kind of the best nose in the animal kingdom. But when what scientists have been looking at the human nose and comparing it to the dog nose, and we put up quite a good show. So I think the myth started, I look back, well, I don't, but a scientist called John McGann actually looked back to see when this myth had started. And he essentially says that it started with Paul Broca, who was a French surgeon who worked in the 19th century. By the time he died in the 1880s, he collected something like 400 brains. So this chap was fascinated by the brain. And he saw that our olfactory bulb is proportionately smaller than the other mammals he was looking at. And so he made this broad, sweeping statement that the olfactory bulb and our sense of smell had made way for frontal lobes and our sense of free will. And this idea was developed by Sigmund Freud, who argued that the sublimation of the sense of smell is a factor of civilization. And the only people who relished smell were children, perverts, and neurotics. So this idea of, they call us micro, we have microsmatty, this idea that our nose is not up for much at all, you know, has basically started here. But scientists today have re-looked at the evidence and have come up with a radically different conclusion. So McGann, for example, looked at the olfactory bulb and argued that in terms of absolute size, we still rank rather well. But also other scientists have looked at, have studied behaviour and, you know, done behavioural tests to pit our nose against the bloodhounds, and our smell sensitivity is rather good. There was a wonderful study done by the Rockefeller University, it's called the Rockefeller University Smell Study, and a chap called Andreas Keller put all sorts of mixes of scents in a test tube and asked people to discriminate between how many scents they could detect in a mix. And using some clever statistics, basically came to the conclusion that we could smell over a trillion different scents. So our range is staggering too. I mean, if you compare it to audible tones, you know, scientists might say we can distinguish between hundreds of thousands of audible tones. And other scientists might say that we can distinguish between a million or more colors. But Keller and his team said we can distinguish between a trillion different scents. So yes, our nose is really rather brilliant.
Well, I suggested at the beginning of this section that to smell a lot better might be a terrible thing. But the opposite is the truth. To think about not smelling at all seems to be, you know, the anosmia, which is some people very recently that have had COVID have had, you know, a short period of experience in this seems, a truly terrible affliction.
So it happened to me actually in January. I caught COVID and I lost my sense of smell. What's not really known about smell, picking things apart, is what most of what we think of as taste is smell. I mean, more particularly, scientists call flavour, which is the mix of taste and smell, it's predominantly smell. So I couldn't taste chocolate, my favourite thing in the world. It just tasted like putty. If anything, I just had this mouthfeel of slip-slidiness in my mouth with kind of a vague sweetness. But all that, those wonderful aromas that normally, you know, my teeth will chew into a piece of chocolate, and these lovely aromas will waft up to the back of my throat and up towards my nose. It's called the retronasal passage. And what's interesting is those smells are registered in our nose, but our brain hoodwinks us into thinking that they're tasted on our tongue. So yes, smell, a loss of smell is not only do you, you know, not enjoy the smell of a rose, but you also don't enjoy your food. You know, people often lose weight because they lose all interest in food, or they put on weight because they're trying to eat for some form of satisfaction and they're not getting it. And it's very much correlated with depression, a loss of smell. Again, this theme again running through the book, this idea that often you don't appreciate these senses until you've lost them.
So we're going to look at a couple of senses that we don't necessarily recognise as senses or are not necessarily aware of. And the first one I wanted to talk about was our sense of balance, literally how we are able to stand up and move about without falling. And to do this, you look at the cheetah, the most incredible of cats.
Yes. Which you think, so the cheetah, we all hail and laud the cheetah for being, you know, the fastest creature on legs. But what we forget is the reason, I mean, if ever you watch a cheetah chasing a gazelle, what you see is not a flat out race. You see the gazelle doing this smart evolutionary tactic of jinking, you know, bouncing from side to side to try and avoid the cheetah. So the cheetah has to turn on a sixpence at high speeds. And so Camille Groet was studying the cheetah and became fascinated by its sense of balance. So our sense of balance, the organ, our sensor, where we sense balance, is in our inner ear, not far from the cochlea where we hear. And so she looked at the cheetah's bony labyrinth and could see that in comparison to all other cats, it was markedly different, much bigger, and certain canals were emphasized. And this enables the cheetah incredible sensitivity when it is spinning on a sixpence. And Camille said that she started to watch these high-speed chases, and she just was, before she'd been fascinated by its kind of liquid beauty, then she became fascinated by the fact that the head, it's like a steady camera, you know, these devices that are kind of on gyros that basically they don't move, that the head is the same distance above the ground. And you've got this Scooby-Doo action of the cheetah's body racing behind the head. But the head is locked in position, and that enables the cheetah to be like a gazelle seeking missile. The cheetah's eyes are locked on the gazelle. So, yeah, it makes it deadly.
And let's talk about this sense of balance in ourselves.
The vestibular system.
Yes.
So what's interesting is the very same canals that were enlarged in the cheetah, a similar enlargement had happened at some point in someone else's evolutionary history, our history. So Fred Spohr became well known for looking at the vestibular system of hominids, ancient hominids, and essentially studied different hominids and realized that the moment that we stood upright, this enlargement, the very same canal enlargement that we'd seen in the cheetah happened in us. And this enlargement enables us to stand tall and walk. Brian Day, this other wonderful scientist who I talked to, who studies human motion, describes walking as an extraordinary feat of balance. Every time we kind of tip forward onto our foot that's hovering in the air and it lands, that's an extraordinary feat of balance that we are conducting without thought. And our balance system is essentially informing our vestibular system, our vestibular organ, is informing our brain all the time of where our body is and whether we're balanced or not. And we couldn't walk without it, or we can walk. There's a chap with that I also discuss, who's a patient of Oliver Sacks, who can walk, but he's walking around. It's misfire. It's not working properly, and he's walking around like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. So yeah,
that's a fascinating story, and he has no idea that he's doing it until he's shown a video of himself.
Yes, and then he realizes, and then understands why his friends have called him the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And what's wonderful, I think, about that particular story is that Sacks then, because of the neuroplasticity of our brain, the fact that our brains are constantly changing according to the information that we're giving them, this chap, Sacks's patient, built himself a pair of spectacles with a little weight hanging from the bridge of his nose. And so as he walked about his day to day, he could see when the pendulum swung to a side, he realized that he was walking at a tilt. So he would look at that pendulum and then right himself. And by doing this over and over and over again, he retrained his brain to rebalance himself. So in that chapter, I talk about both the organ in the ear and the brain and combined that, you know, there's a big debate with these, you know, what's the sensory organ and the brain, essentially. This is not my quote, it's Paul Bakarita's quote, but he talks about the brain being the key sensory organ of the body. And all these little sensors in our extremities are collecting information from the world and feeding it to the brain. And the brain combines everything with our multi-sensory perception to sense the world.
To finish off then, we're just going to talk about one more animal, and this is one where to actually discuss where the line between the senses and the brain and the body ends is difficult, and I'm talking about the octopus.
The octopus, yes.
And you talk here about another one of those, well, both very strange, and actually this is a sense that, you know, most people would not know of, but also probably wouldn't be able to pronounce. I'm talking about proprioception. Which is, well, yeah, tell us what this is.
So, Neil, if you close your eyes right now, you've got a sense of where your body is. And the sense is so so accurate that with your eyes closed, you can bring your finger to your nose tip. And this is You've just done that. And this is a test that policemen use if they've caught you speeding late at night, because proprioception quickly gets addled by alcohol. So if you're stabbing yourself in the eye, then essentially it means you've had a drink, because your proprioception's no longer firing on all cylinders. So yes, it's a sense that we are incredibly reliant on, and none of us realise how reliant. And I met Ian Waterman, whose story is extraordinary.
Yeah, it certainly is.
When he was 19 years old, he got a nasty viral infection. He started to feel quite unwell. I think he was pushing the lawnmower across. He basically was at work. He was working as a butcher's assistant and he felt ill. And his boss said, go home. And rather than go to bed, he decided to mow the lawn. This is classic Ian. And he couldn't keep up with the lawnmower. He went to bed. He had these fever dreams that he was floating above the bed. His body felt rather odd. He woke up in the middle of the night. There was a hand on his face and the hand was his. And he ended up in hospital. And when he kind of came to, you know, out of the fevers, He had lost all sense of his body. So if he closed his eyes, like I just asked you to do, he had no idea where any part of his body was. So it's not like a numbness, like an anesthetic numbness. He had lost his body. I mean, the doctors had no idea what to do with him. And he essentially re-taught himself how to move and walk again. He was sent home and he thought, rather than lie on the bed, I've just got to sort this out. Because the whole point of this sense is it doesn't just enable us to feel our body. It enables us to control our body. So, for example, his arm, he hadn't lost motion. He told me this extraordinary thing. He'd be in the doctors, and if he wasn't looking, his arm just might kind of start moving off to the side and equally likely go up someone's nose, he said. The moment he realised that the only way that he could take control of his body was to look at his body and use his eyes and his sense of sight to basically reclaim possession of his body. And he essentially did the most extraordinary study of human movement that's possibly ever been done, because he took every single motion that he had to get his head around and he broke it down into its component parts, and then he built it back up. And with attention and bloody mindedness and strong will, he basically started to command his body to move using his eyes. And he does this today, and he can walk and he can move around. But if he loses sight of what he's doing, if the lights go out, if he's momentarily blinded by a firework, you know, that blackness you get just after a firework, if he sneezes, he will crumple like a rag doll, because he's lost proprioception, he's lost that connection he's got with his vision to his body, he will fall. So he talks about his every day of just getting up in the morning and going about and having a regular day as a daily marathon. The focus and the attention that he has to bring to bear on a simple day is a marathon. And his marathon is what we do every day without even thinking about it.
Well, we've gone straight to this, you know, incredible story of Ian Waterman there. And let's finish off talking about how this relates to the relation of this sense to the octopus, which is the animal that the chapter is about.
So I told Ian that of all humanity, he has most in common with the octopus, which he loves. call me Inky, he says. And Inky is the character that opens the chapter, and it enables me to talk about these marvellous creatures. You know, Inky essentially escaped. He's a New Zealand common octopus who escaped from his aquarium. And octopuses, we've heard all sorts of tales of their intelligence, their ability to solve mazes, to recognise faces. And we've seen, or if we haven't seen, please see My Octopus Teacher, the Netflix film. But I decided to look at the octopus with regard to its sense of proprioception, because it's fascinating. Essentially, very little proprioception information that the arms, its eight arms are collecting. Very little of that information reaches the brain. So these arms are essentially divorced from the brain. They're autonomous. They're doing their own thing. And so a little bit like Ian, if an octopus is, you know, regular day on the reef for an octopus, it might be watching a fish. But meanwhile, its arm will be doing something that its head is unaware of. So its arms essentially can do their own thing. And again, like Ian, vision, it uses vision to unify itself. So when it starts to, if it wants to swim off and basically unify itself and have some cohesive movement, it's doing so with its eyes. So it's a fascinating creature. It makes us rethink. I mean, it makes us, you mentioned the brain-body division. It makes us rethink whether we should have a division between the brain and, you know, we often talk about the brain-body division, but as my octopus scientist, Benny Hockner, says, and he's been studying these creatures because he wants to build the holy grail of robots, which is to build a soft-bodied robot. And he's looking at the octopus and its proprioception and its movement to enable him to do that. He talks of embodied intelligence and, you know, argues that the brain is part of the body. And with the octopus, a third of its half billion neurons are in its brain, but the rest of the other two thirds are all in its arms. Octopus is very far removed from us. You know, it's a mollusk. It's physiologically more like an oyster than a trout, let alone a mammal. So it's so far removed from us on our family tree, but it's another mind.
So I've been talking to Jackie Higgins. We've been talking about her new book, Sentient, What Animals Reveal About Our Senses, which is out in the UK from Picador. Jackie, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Not at all, Neil. It was great fun. Thank you for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.